IRS on the Road, value-based parenting and life balance ideas from world-traveling family coaches. Here's Richard and Linda Iyer.
Hello and welcome back to IRS on the Road. We are into August right now. I don't know what you're into, but wow, it is amazing this summer.
They're into August too.
No, they might not. They might not be listening for another month.
Oh, true. That's true.
So anyway, we do want to say a great thank you to BYU Radio, this podcast, and Jane Finlayson, who is so wonderful to work with. It has been such a pleasure. And this whole summer has been just wild, but we do appreciate them so much.
We really do. Whenever we call and need to change the recording time with James, he always writes back one word, yep, YUP, we can do it. And we do appreciate that, and we appreciate BYU Radio. And here we go. You know, we're at Bear Lake still. We spend a lot of our summer here trying to finish writing projects and being with family members and so on. And today we got up and looked out, and you never can quite put your finger on it, Linda, but the light is a little different. The slant of light, it's just, there's this autumnal feeling just creeping in just a little bit because we're so far north here. And autumn sort of starts to manifest itself a little earlier than maybe it should.
Yeah, the grass is turning gold, the grasses in the fields. And it's amazing, however, not in Salt Lake City. It's
still, very, very hot, and hot in so many parts of the world right now. And so many fires and so much flooding. We're seeing the smoke from the California fires clear up here in Idaho. So hang on, folks. And the other thing that's happening earlier and earlier is school's starting. A lot of you are probably,
my goodness,
just about headed back to school. Our grandkids in Arizona have been in school already for like
July
a couple
22nd,
weeks.
I think.
I don't know. I think it should be crazy. A rule that you have to get out of school on Memorial Day and you can't start again until Labor Day. But that's how it used to be.
It used to be that way. Yeah. If you can imagine.
But
anyway, we're off and on. So we are thrilled to be here today. It is beautiful where we are. We hope it's beautiful where you are too. But we have something kind of fun and kind of serious to talk about today, as well as some fun things.
Yeah, let us, and some of you who listen regularly know we're doing this series of articles this summer, all summer long, one article every weekend for the whole summer, regarding the what we believe is a very family-centric lens through which to view religion and faith and the gospel. And we really believe that theology in general, Christian theology, makes more sense when it is viewed through a family lens, when it is viewed through the lens that the scriptures so often say that the important thing in the world relating to the promise of Elijah is that the hearts of the fathers turn to the children and the hearts of the children turn to the fathers. This family bonding, this linking, we actually believe that heaven will be a family-centered place, and that the government of God, if you will be a family government, and that our families will fit into God's family, that we're all children of God, we're all part of his family. And in that sense, we think the church makes the most sense and is the most realistically viewed as what one of our prophets once said, the church is the scaffolding with which we build eternal families. And that doesn't surprise any of you who know Linda and Richard Iyer that we're orienting everything to family, but we really think it makes sense. And so we've been doing this series of articles, and the one for this weekend is, I think, a really interesting one, because it asks the question, how does society in general, suffer when the family is no longer its basic unit. People have said that forever, that the family is the basic unit of society. But is that really true anymore? Or are we more focused on the individual, almost to the expense of the responsibility and sacrifice of families? And you may say, well, what is that? Why does that matter to me? It matters to all of us, because if our families really are the basic unit, and again, we define family very broadly. We're not just talking about people who have children. We're talking about family in the sense that we're all linked. We're all aunts or uncles or children or cousins or whatever. And it's that family linkage that really is thicker than water.
It is amazing, though, how much is becoming the world of the individual. And it's kind of scary in a way, because we grew up, and many of you listeners grew up in an era when family was central. I mean, that's what the world was made from,
the
family.
There's no question.
But now it is really interesting that it's moving away. Now, not to be the bringers of gloom and doom, because there are fabulous families in the world.
In fact, we think the best families ever exist today because of the equality between parents.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you think about the Leave It to Beaver days, mom was always referring to the dad, whatever you want, dear, and so on.
Let's not go back to those good old days.
But it really is so interesting, because great families have become great partnerships for the parents, and the kids have done so many amazing things. We see the good as well as the harm that's coming.
So let's jump right in and read you the opening paragraph of this article this week that we're going to kind of expand for you a little bit this morning.
The eighth family-centric essay, which is this one today, will try to zero in on a mixture of social and spiritual questions, such as, why do marrieds, quote-unquote, do better financially and psychologically than singles, quote-unquote? Why is the admonition to turn the hearts of parents to children and vice versa repeated so often in Scripture? And what is the shocking warning that goes with this admonition? Why don't we know more about the relationships between our heavenly parents? Is it accurate or appropriate to think of family as a financial incentive? Who are the two democratic groups with the strongest families in the world?
Demographic groups. We don't want to get political here.
I thought that's what I said. Anyway, demographic groups with the strongest families in the world today. And why are there not more connections between these two groups? What are the dramatic differences between a culture centered on commitment and family and one focused on freedom and the individual? It's a good question.
Now, when I was writing this article that we're going to expand a little for you now, my initial idea was I'm going to address these questions, at least the sociological ones, with numbers and data. I'm going to throw out the statistics that basically prove how societies and economics work better when their basic unit is the family. But the more I thought about that, I realized that we don't need to prove that. People inherently know that. And what we need to do is to talk more about how we can be part of it, how it can influence us personally, how it can help and change our families. We love how David Brooks, he kind of is one of our favorite columnists and writers, and he summarized this and what we're really trying to say here in a very concise number of words.
For that, he says, people are not better off when they're given maximum personal freedom to do what they want. They're better off when they're enshrouded in commitments that transcend personal choice. Commitments to family, God, craft, and country.
And I think we sort of know that inherently, that this misinterpretation of freedom that we see a lot in the world today, of individuals who say, I got to keep all my options open. If I make commitments, if I get married, if I have kids, I'm shrinking my freedom. I'm limiting my options. And we know that that's a false kind of freedom. It's a kind that really enslaves people And that's what David Brooks is talking about. People are not better off when they're given maximum personal freedom. We need responsibility and commitments. That's what makes us grow. That's what makes us selfless instead of selfish. And by the way, we can go back a lot further than David Brooks. Here's how Confucius said it thousands of years ago.
To put the world in order, we must first put the nation in order. To put the nation in order, we must first put the family in order. To put the family in order, we must first cultivate our personal life. We must first set our hearts right. I love that.
So we know these things are true. The question is, how do we really do it? And let me tell a story really quickly, and then we'll use this as kind of a way to explain what we're really trying to get at here. Many years ago, I had the opportunity to speak in Cape Town, South Africa, to the Global Leadership Conference of the Young Presidents Organization, or YPO. We love YPO. It's a group we've spoken to literally hundreds of times around the world, different chapters, different organization. But they're an interesting group because to join it, you have to be the CEO of a company, a reasonably large company. They have financial levels they have to meet, and you have to be that before you're 40 years old. So by definition, these are young, vibrant, sort of aggressive type A people who become members of YPO, and we love to speak to them because what they need is to focus their attention on relationships and family, where so often it's focused on their companies. At any rate, back to the story, I was there in Cape Town and giving this address, no surprise, was on families and why our family relationships should be the highest priority. But here's the interesting thing. The keynote speaker at that conference was Bishop Desmond Tutu. Did you picture him in your mind, a small, diminutive bishop in South Africa who worked side by side with Nelson Mandela to overthrow apartheid and to bring racial and political freedom to that whole country?
It just makes me smile when I think of him. He's just such a stellar person. Yeah. And he and Nelson Mandela, when we were in South Africa, we realized they were neighbors.
They grew up in the same little ghetto, the same
almost
little
the same street, I think. It's amazing.
But anyway, he was the keynote speaker, and it was just amazing because he got up to the podium. I'd spoken earlier in the conference, and now this was his keynote. And instead of giving an oration or having a text, he just said, I'm here to answer your questions. What are your questions? One of the most intriguing queries he got, although I have to smile when I think this because it's sometimes the question you hear of beauty pageant contestants, right? Like, how do we get world peace? I mean, it's just this broad question, but someone actually asked him that.
Well, no, nothing against beauty pageants.
No, I'm just saying, you know.
I know, but anyway.
And it was so interesting. He said, well, he pondered it for a minute, took the question seriously, and he kept his answer short and simple. He, in essence, he said he thought the world peace would have a better chance of becoming a reality when we elect more women to high offices and to run countries. The only postscript I remember he said to that was, I do not think that mothers will send their children to war. I've just thought that was so interesting over the years to think about that. Now, it doesn't mean there aren't aggressive political
Margaret
women.
Thatcher, for example. there are a lot of aggressive women in politics, but it is really amazing that they do have a different heart. I think they, by and large, I don't think they would send their sons to war.
Well, and the reason I'm telling that story is I was sitting there listening that day and thinking, he's really saying what I tried to speak about earlier in the day, essentially that society is better and more peaceful when we operate from a family-centric paradigm, when we put children and family as our first priority. And when we do that, and family really is the basic unit of society, the economy flourishes, we're more likely to avoid war and conflict, We've re-enshrined the family as the basic unit. And that's just a powerful, powerful thing in the world. And it leads to this scripture that we quote so often, and it occurs many times in the scriptures. And I think we ought to spend a minute on this.
The scripturally often repeated phrase, turn the hearts of the children to the fathers and the fathers to the children. And may I add mothers? Also,
yes, of course.
Is both the mission of Elijah and the key admonition for our time. All of the uses of this powerful couplet, which occurs in all the standard works, suggests that the connection of generations and the priority of family is the purpose of mortality. Note that the two most ominous scriptures using this phrase come in Malachi 4:6, where God says that if hearts are not turned in this way, he will smite the earth with a curse. And D&C 2:2-3, where we are told that if this turning does not occur, the whole earth would be utterly wasted at his coming.
So that's pretty powerful.
Scary,
curse, or what is the curse? What is, in what way is the earth wasted if families don't flourish? And it becomes sort of self-evident that we lose the connections, we lose the relationships, we lose the sacrifice, we lose the responsibility that we need to have to make the world work. So let's take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to try to flesh that in and make it a little more personal. How can we turn our hearts? How can we be part of the solution rather than part of the problem?
Hang on, we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Iyer's on the Road. Here's Richard and Linda Iyer.
And we're back. Guess what we're talking about today? Families.
Surprise, surprise.
Big surprise, yeah. Okay, so we have really thought about this pretty seriously, and I'm sure you have too. It's a concern with the church, our church, as well as many churches. It is really something to think about.
You know, giving a little personal perspective, I don't know if you've thought of this, Linda, but it's exactly 10 years since you and I published, I think, what may have been our most scholarly attempt at a book in our whole lives, or the one we worked the hardest on in terms of research.
Yeah.
And it's a book called The Turning, and the subtitle is Why the State of the Family Matters and What the World Can Do About It. Pretty audacious title, but we really worked hard on that. And one of the things we listed was 9 turning points that we felt were danger signals, were signals that we were losing this paradigm of the family as the basic unit of society. And I think we ought to read those points just briefly, the tipping points, the things we felt were really going wrong in the world vis-a-vis families. And the reason I want to read these, they're all worse now, 10 years later. They were bad in 2014.
Right, yeah.
As we read them, think of how much worse they've become today. And again, this is a little gloom and doom, but we'll try to be more optimistic at the end. But let's alternate just reading these quickly, and you see if that doesn't mean, wow, the family really does need to be re-enshrined.
Okay, number one, we're very close to the point where there will be more U.S. adults who are single than who are married. For the first time, fewer than 50% of U.S. households are made up of married couples, and only 25% of 20 to 29-year-olds are married, compared with 70% in 1960. That's amazing.
And guess what? That was 10 years ago, and now there are more. We've tipped that point. There are more U.S. adults who are single than married. Point number two, in several Western countries, very nearly as many children are now born out of wedlock as in. Well, we've tipped that point. There are more born out of wedlock than in.
Number three, more U.S. marriages now end in divorce than stay together.
Number four, in many major world cities, there are now more households that are occupied by one single individual than households that are inhabited by any kind of families. People are living alone more and more.
Yeah. For example, number five, in England, a majority of women of childbearing age say they would rather buy a house than have a child. And one third say they do not ever want children. In some Asian countries, there are more women between 20 and 40 who say they do not want children than who say they do.
In the United States and Europe, among couples that move in together, far more choose cohabitation than marriage.
Number seven, more than half of Hispanic children in the United States are now raised in fatherless homes. And among African-American families, 7 in 10 kids are raised without a family.
Throughout the world, higher percentages now seem to believe that family should support the career, quote unquote, than who believe the opposite, that the career should support the family.
Number nine, for the first time, more than half of the nations on the planet, 116 of Earth's 224 countries recognize sovereign states and countries have birth rates below the replacement level of 2.1 children per woman, and now must either encourage more births or count on immigration to maintain their workforce.
We've had so many experiences.
So scary. Yes, we have.
Singapore, and they're actually paying. There's a cash bonus for any woman who has a child because their birth rate is below one.
Yeah. At that time, I think it was $20,000, $10,000 or something. Yeah. Anyway, a lot of money just paying women to have babies. They were desperate for them.
But let us repeat, this was the list 10 years ago. And now 10 years later, every one of these tipping points has tipped further. Take that last one you read, for example, and 10 years ago, there were several U.S. states that had birth rates above the replacement level. Now there are none. Utah was the highest birth rate, and now even Utah is below the replacement level of 2.1.
Which is kind of breathtaking. Wow.
It really is. Let us just carry a little further with the YPO, the Young Presidents Organization story, because it allows us to make a really important point.
It's really a prime example that we observed as we went around the world with these beautiful people, something that may mitigate the gloom and doom of the projected tipping point just listed. These were educated, well-off people who have had financial freedom and high education awareness to look at the world and their own situation with perspective and insight. And now coming to the conclusion that married with children is the best and happiest way to live. For more than three decades, we've been speaking to these local chapters, regional conferences, and global gatherings of this interesting organization, and have come to know hundreds, if not thousands, of its members. To join YPO, this is again the Young Presidents Organization, one must be a president and CEO of a relatively large company before turning 40. So by definition, these are men and women who are highly and early successful in the world's terms. Educated at the best universities, most with graduate degrees, they have in their early midlife the options to live however and wherever they choose and adopt their whatever lifestyle they want. And they're generally secular. Many have spiritual beliefs. Many of them do.
Yeah.
But overall, they're not highly religious, but they're analytical and aggressive, and they want to be the best.
And generally speaking, this subset of the world, not because someone told them or preached it to them or because it's part of their religion, but simply because they have observed and figured it out, they have concluded that, quote, married with children is simply the best and the happiest way to live. And that's why we've really admired a lot of these people, Linda, because they have just, you know, they've had the luxury of seeing the world and basically come to the conclusion there are a lot of ways to live, and the best one is to make commitments, settle down. Their divorce rate is fairly low. Their number of children they're having is above average. And I think the reason we take a lot of comfort in that is because this YPO group is representative of a whole demographic. And it is the demographic of college-educated, upper-income people who are the ones who are now getting married and the ones who are having children and the ones who are trying to stay together. The sad part is that those with less education and with less income, and again, I'm generalizing, but it certainly holds true financially, they're the ones saying, I can't even afford to be married. I can't even afford to have a child. And they're the ones where families are losing out the most. But we're a little bit optimistic because generally speaking, trends are set by the ones who are a little more educated and have a little more access to media and to outreach and so on. They're the ones that are pushing for stronger. They're the ones that are setting the example of more committed, strong families.
And actually, it used to be totally different. You know, the really strong families were the lower income families who were committed to their children and so on. I mean, we're talking about the past, but there's still all that in the present. We don't want to make this sound like, you know, there's no other group I'm sure that the YPO had lots of problems and we only saw the bright side, but it really was pretty amazing how committed they were to their families and a lot of them to religion. It's sad that religion come very often.
But you make a powerful point, Linda, because of course, when people attend church and when they especially have a Christian faith or a Muslim faith or a Jewish faith, when they have a faith, that almost always points them in the direction of families. So what we're getting to, what's so fascinating, is that we live in a world where the two demographic groups that value families most, one is church-committed people who gravitate toward commitment in families because of their faith, and the other one is largely secular but well-educated people who gravitate to family simply because they've concluded it's the best way to live.
Right. I do have to say, though, that we were immersed in the Muslim world, the Sikh world, the Hindu world, and so on. And I think they were more committed to their family than the secular families that we had. I mean, they were, amazing to see how amazing they were, amazingly committed they were to their families. A lot of love, but it was surrounding a love of God. And I think that was really, really interesting.
So that's kind of where we're going. That's where we want to kind of conclude with this whole essay in the last 4 or 5 minutes here, that, you know, there really are two powerful, these are very big groups, and I'm not trying to make a demographic statement here, but when you think about it, those who have faith and follow a faith tradition are moving and constantly pulled in the direction of making commitments, having families, staying married if they're married, looking to get married if they're not married, having children, making those children their first priority, focusing their life, focusing their careers on how they can best support the family, and so on. And that's a huge, powerful demographic group. Some say it's slipping because religious attendance and observation throughout the world is slipping. But it remains a powerful group of family-focused individuals. And the other group, again, which is very, very different, mostly secular, mostly not connected to powerful religious traditions in their everyday lives, but educated and aware of the world and aware of society. And it's those higher educated, better perspective people who are the other group where marriage is increasing and the number of children is actually increasing. And there's a real effort to focus on a family-centered, committed life.
Yeah, it's really been fascinating to see and to watch. And wow, you just feel so much love for them when you see that they've got it and they love their children so much that's their first priority. We were really blessed to have that wonderful experience.
So let us end by getting a little religious ourselves, a little spiritual here, and and suggesting what this sort of figuring it out example has led us to believe.
When we found ourselves admiring these YPO friends in what they're doing in cases without, in some cases without the help of faith or religion, that they'd figured it out, that family commitments and priorities are a path to good and happy lives. It was really interesting.
So maybe there's a similar kind of figuring it out that can happen in the minds and hearts of those who are religious, and particularly those who really believe in a parental God, believing that we have heavenly parents, believing that God is literally our Father. Maybe within that group, we need to try to figure things out too. Questions like, why don't we know more about our heavenly parents? And why don't we hear more from Christ himself on families and on the whole idea of commitments? And how does the Holy Spirit lead us in those directions and so on? And I think we know more than we think we do. We know about God's familial commitments and relationships and priorities through what he tells us to pursue and value. We know our goal is to try to grow gradually more like God, and therefore we know that his commitment is to family and to marriage. And so we can begin to follow that, and we can view God's commandments as loving counsel from a wise father. And he gives us the gospel with its insights and priorities, and gives us covenants and commitments and commandments and so on that we can make. And he gives us the Holy Spirit and the light of Christ. And he gives us agency within that to figure it out. And we need to figure out that family is our priority.
Yeah, I think figuring it out is really essential. And sometimes it takes a lifetime for some people, but it is really fascinating to think what is really, really important. And you realize the family is important. Well, now we realize that we're speaking to a lot of people who have a lot of family angst and family problems, and we have our own share. This morning we're worried about something.
Like, yes, we are.
Kids, and we know that there are just worries that happen along the way. But that's part of the process of learning what you can do to make it work with your family, to use the atonement of Jesus Christ to make it happen.
Now, we've just had some of the highlights of this article that we've been working on. If you're interested in reading the details and going deeper into this article, so easy to find, just put in your browser Meridian Magazine, and it'll come right up, and our article is the cover story. Or if you want the actual website, it's Latter-day Saint Mag, LatterdaySaintMag.com.
M-A-G, yeah.
And you'll get this article. And we hope you enjoy it. And we've been glad to chat with you today. And we're excited about the end of summer and concluding this series and being with you next week.
So we'll see you next time on Irish on the Road.
Thanks for joining.